definition I've read of concentration is profitable unification of mind. Do you know what they mean by profitable?
Never heard.
I'm assuming it allows you to maybe accomplish an aim.
Possibly. I mean, I've never heard that, but yeah.
It's in the path of purification.
Oh, profitable
unification.
I don't need to be speculating like you. I mean, I've never heard that way of phrasing it. But, yeah, it's probably something like that, I imagine.
Before we left, we were talking about the concentration through the shamatha meditation. And I was just curious on your thoughts about that. I got to bring this up in my group about them using the shamatha meditation to alleviate PTSD symptoms. And people, mainly like African refugees, is who they've been using it with. And it reduces them after 10 days by 40%, and then by another 10 days, after another 10 days, another 40%, and then by the end of 30 days, apparently their symptoms are gone. Is that, I mean, what are your thoughts on that?
Of course, I think a lot of these tools, particularly this idea of mindfulness, can be used, I think, if not to cure, but to help at least alleviate symptoms in a number of different areas. And I think there's a lot of work being done in the last years for that purpose. You know, we have the very well-known mindfulness-based stress reduction program to reduce stress. And then I think there's also a mindfulness-based cognitive therapy, which is also using mindfulness-based tools to work with depression and so forth. So I think there are a number of encouraging signs that really this attention skills can be very helpful in many areas. But I think, of course, how they're presented here is assuming that we have a sort of minimum level of mental health. And the goal of this is to develop this single point of concentration. So it's packaged in that way. So I think with these other areas where it could be of benefit, then I think a lot often it's in the fairly early stages of packaging that in a way that would be accessible and useful for that person for that purpose. But it seems like it's, yeah, in a lot of areas it is really becoming quite useful. But again, the challenge is, of course, is to package it in such a way that it can be of some help. And of course, sometimes in these various areas, it may not actually cure the problem, but at least it could relieve the symptoms enough to be able to use other methodologies to work at the underlying problem and come up with a solution. Because, you know, if our mind is not in any sort of mental health state, then it's hard to implement a lot of ideas to overcome problems. Whereas this at least could hopefully help to reduce the symptoms to get to that minimum level of mental health to be able to use other methodologies as well. And I mean, of course, we're using similar principle here, is that shamatha itself is not going to cure our mental afflictions, but it will provide a state whereby we can go into Vipassana practice, which will then, in theory, cure our mental afflictions.
Just a quick random thought. Alzheimer's concerns in my family, does shamatha practice do anything? I mean, just like focus on the thing I was wondering.
Yeah, I mean, of course, there's been, there are now, of course, a number of studies being done in the area of neuroscience with mindfulness practices, and a lot of these studies are showing that even quite minimal amount of meditation can really affect the brain, you know, rewire the brain, you know, this idea of plasticity, you know, and even very short amounts of meditation seem to be able to help to rewire the brain and increase gray matter and all sorts of things. So, again, I think it's in very early stages, and there may be they can come up with some ways of helping alleviate in these other areas. But personally, I have no understanding of that area at the moment. So, but I think it could be something that could benefit, maybe.
And if you could comment on, it sounded like Einstein when you spoke about there being no boundaries in the universe. He's like, you know, in special relativity, there's no privileged frame, no objective point of view on the universe.
Hmm.
So it's like the universe itself doesn't have a perspective. You have to bring it to it.
I think it can be something, sometimes the parallel is drawn there. Of course, maybe we're not saying they're equal, but there are parallels there, and you know, what we can understand from this emptiness, particularly the idea of dependent arising, is that everything is really perspective. Because often when people look at the idea of dependency, they sort of view it that there's this one thing here and there's one thing here and somehow they're connected. But this view is saying there's not one thing here and one thing here. It's the relationship which defines the endpoints, isn't it? We're working up to this. Yeah, I mean, we're coming to this. It'll come later in this session. Okay, so let's now look at how we can go about investigating this. Again, very much in this particular approach in the Lam Rim, it's very much recommended that we start our investigation by focusing on ourselves as a person in meditation. But here, and you find in the texts, to establish the view of emptiness through reasoning, then often they use, as an example, a physical object. And here, this Lam Rim, in this area, is based again on Nagarjuna's work, but in particular on a commentary from Chandrakirti on Nagarjuna. And in that commentary, Chandrakirti establishes this view of emptiness using the chariot or cart. And so that's what we see here down the bottom, is giving the example. It says, taking as an example the imputation of a chariot in dependence upon its parts, such as its wheels, the Buddha states that the self or living being is also imputed in dependence upon the aggregates. Therefore, I'll first explain the example of the chariot. So again, using a physical example of how we can come to investigate, to come to see that there is not, it doesn't, things don't exist independently. So it says here, the way of investigation here in the next paragraph is what's called the sevenfold reasoning. And it starts with a chariot is neither asserted to be other than its parts nor to be non-other. So basically the reasoning here is that the chariot is not the same as the parts and it's not different from the parts. So then if there is a independently existing chariot, it can only be one of two things. It either has to be the same or different than the parts. There's no other option. So if we can investigate and see that the chariot is neither the same as the parts or different from the parts, then there can be no inherently independently existent chariot. But then here we have five other ways of investigating, but we can come to realize that things like asking, here it says, it does not possess them, it does not depend on the parts do not depend on it, it is neither mere the collection of the parts nor is the shape. Those other five options are really variations of either same or different. They're just sort of to be more complete. But effectively, the only two valid options is that the chariot, if it really exists inherently, independently, it has to be the same as its parts or different than the parts. And so this is what we can do, is using this two, same or different, or if we want to be more complete, do the other five options as well, just to make sure. But of course, they're not anything else. They're still covering the same two options. By using the chariot, then, in that way, we can come to see, as it says here, a chariot is a mere imputation since it does not exist in these seven ways. So by coming to see that, that the chariot is not the same in the parts or different in the parts, we can understand that the chariot is something just merely imputed depending on its parts. And so this is Chandrakirti in his text goes through, and also in the Lam Rim here, there's a whole big section about going through that, but we won't go through that now, just to understand that the principle of the search of same and different. And then we can then go over the page and then apply that in terms of how to investigate the person, which is showing what the example illustrates near the top of page 42. And it says here, just as a chariot does not intrinsically exist in any of the seven ways, but is still posited in dependence upon its parts, the self does not intrinsically exist in any of the seven ways, one with the aggregates, different from the aggregates, and so forth, yet it is still imputed in dependence upon the aggregates. So this then gives us the way of doing this reflection on ourself as a person, the meditation in looking at the person. And often this is described as the four essential points. So in this meditation where we are going to investigate ourselves as a person and to see how we exist, the first step is the most important, and that's what we looked at before, is that we have to what's called identify the object of negation. And here, what we're talking about, of course, is to clearly see how we view ourselves existing now. Because what we are going, what we grasp onto now is we believe there's an independent me here. And that we need to clearly identify how we see ourselves existing and then to look and see whether we exist in fact in that way. So this is the most important point, is to clearly get a picture of how we see ourselves existing. Of course, instinctively, not intellectually. You know, some of us have sometimes some quite elaborate ideas about how we think we exist based on what we've read and so forth. But our behavior is not really driven by our intellectual idea of who we think we are or how we think we exist. It's driven by our instinctive sense of me. And that's what we need to clearly identify. What is the instinctive sense of me that I have now in my behavior? This is the most important point. If we don't get this right, then the rest doesn't work very well. For example, if we are going to look for a person in a crowded room of people, but we don't clearly know what the person looks like, then if we look in the room, we're not going to be sure if they're there. We might think, well, maybe that's that person, I'm not sure. So we have to have a clear picture of how we see ourselves, because then if we don't, if we do the search, we're not going to be sure whether we exist in that way or not. So, therefore, we need to get that clear picture. And in as a beginner, when we start to do this meditation, then often it's recommended that we begin this meditation by artificially generating a strong sense of me and then becoming familiar with that. Because often when we sit down in meditation, we relax the body, relax the mind, then the sense of me often becomes very quiet. We don't notice it. It's there, of course, but as a beginner, we sort of don't have a clear, we don't clearly notice it. So often as a beginning point, it's recommended in the meditation to artificially think of a situation where you have a strong sense of me. So often in the text, it says things like, think of an occasion where someone's criticizing you for something you never did. And usually when that happens, we have a strong sense of me. Another example sometimes given is, imagine you're standing on the edge of a cliff and someone comes up behind you and gives you a little nudge. Then, you know, we have a strong sense of me. Or, on the other side, imagine someone is praising you for something good you did. Then also we have a strong sense of me. So often then in the beginning part of the meditation, the person who's introducing this meditation to you will say, think about this, and then get in touch with that sense of me that we have on that occasion. Because that's the basis of our behavior. And so that's what we need to sit there and become clear that this instinctive sense of me, because that's the basis of our behavior, not our intellectual idea of who we think we are or how we think we exist based on what we've read or heard or something. So sometimes, I mean, this is the most important point. If we can get a clear picture here, the rest becomes a lot easier. You'll be doing a meditation on this later today with Venerable Dolma, and I think she'll be probably giving one of these examples to get this clear picture. The second point, often in the text, the technical word is establishing the pervasion, but these four essential points are described very clearly in this book I mentioned earlier from His Holiness Dalai Lama, How to See Yourself as You Really Are. He goes through that in a very clear way. And here, the identifying the object of negation, I think he calls it something like identifying the target. And the second one, which normally in the text is, the technical term is establishing the pervasion, I think he calls in this book limiting the possibilities. The second step is to simply understand that if there is an independent me, then it can only exist in one of two places. It's either the same as the body and the mind or different than the body and the mind. And that if we look in both of those places and we don't find it, it does not exist. So in the second step, we haven't started searching yet, is simply to understand that if this independent me that seems to be here, if it really exists, it can only be found either as the same as the body and the mind or different than the body and the mind. And if we don't find it as either being the same as the body and the mind or different, it cannot exist. So that's what it means by limiting the possibilities, meaning limiting the search possibilities. Where do we have to search to conclusively determine whether or not this me exists? And if we don't find it in either of those two places, the independent me cannot exist. So that's the second step. Then the third and fourth step are to do the search. And as with the chariot example, if there is this independent me, it can only be either the same as the parts, i.e. the same as the body and the mind, or different than the body and the mind. They're the only two possibilities. So if we search in those two places, that's where we need to search. So we can do this in either order. Usually it's listed first that we search amongst the body and the mind. To see whether or not the me is the same as the body and the mind. So we need to search within the body and the mind for the me. If we don't find it, the only other place to look is different than the body and the mind. Of course, the only logical place it could sort of maybe be is the same as the body and the mind, because different than the body and the mind would imply that you'd have to be able to take the body and the mind away and still be left with the me. But we never have a sense of me except on the basis of some aspect of the body and the mind. But to be complete, we need to search there, because these are the two places. If we don't find either the me amongst the body and the mind or different than the body and the mind, then it cannot exist. So if we've done the search and we don't find, then we stop searching. And we simply hold that experience of not finding. That's an experience of emptiness. And we hold that with, use that as our object of our stabilizing meditation. So now the shamatha mind, the stable, clear mind, simply holds that as long as you can.
Holds the conclusion or the experience?
The experience of not finding. Of course, part of that not finding, if we have followed the procedure properly, it is with an understanding that there's no independent me. So if we have followed the process correctly, then that not finding will also, with, together with that not finding, we will have the understanding or experience or realization that there is no independent me. So we need to hold that experience as long as we can. Now, normally what happens, of course, is if we get to that experience, then we get distracted, dull, or we just get spaced out. So if we lose the experience, then it's said to go back and start the process again, do it again. This is why also the shamatha practice is very important here, because otherwise this experience of not finding, it won't really penetrate very much in our mind. It'll just sort of be some vague idea. Now, often when people begin this practice, they can be a couple of different experiences. Very common when people begin this practice is have the experience of fear arising. Generally in this practice, if fear arises, it's a very good sign. It usually implies that we're following the process in a good way. But what's happening is that we are searching and we're not finding, and we are then misinterpreting that not finding as, oh, I don't exist. So then often when people begin this meditation, they start to have a lot of fear, believing they're going out of existence. So if you're having this experience, again, generally it's a good sign. It means you're doing the search in a correct way. You're simply coming to the wrong conclusion. So what can help with that, of course, is, later to do more reflection about the implications of this search. But at the time, what can be very helpful is if we're fearing that we feel like we're going out of existence, is you can simply ask the question, who's having the fear? If there's no one, there's no me here, there can be no fear. So you're not going out of existence. Don't worry. It's irrational fear. Because the only thing going out of existence is a false sense of me. A false sense of me that actually is the root of our mental afflictions and suffering. So if we have reflected on these points, as we did in the medium capacity person, if we've really internalized these points, then often people, when they start this meditation, instead of having some fear experience, they have a lot of joy. Because they realize experientially that this me, this independent me that I've believed in my entire life, that is the source of all my mental afflictions and sufferings, simply doesn't exist. So that is some experiences that often people have. And you'll be practicing this, I think, this afternoon session, using this approach. So maybe then if there's any questions about that now.
Yeah. So then the karma going forward is not the me. It is just the resultant of the actions So when that karma kicks in, you would not expect you to be there. It can be an entirely different thought system, everything system.
Yeah. I mean, what you're sort of asking, I'm going to think touch on is the next topic.
Okay.
So maybe we can leave it till then.
Then the second part of it is, I had it until the me can't exist without the body and mind, because that kind of already says that there's no independent existence.
Sure.
If it has to be together. But it kind of lost me at the same time, so I don't know how to fix
this
that.
This one?
When you were saying that, you know, you search for it, but then you give the caveat of, but, you know, you can't find it in either place, but yet you can't take those away. It can't exist without them.
Right.
The me can't exist
right.
Without them.
So remember that, so the key here is this point. Is, and that's where often people go wrong in this process, is that here we are to clearly identify the me that we are believing in, this that really seems very solid and real.
Okay.
That's the me we need to look for, because that's the me that we're identifying with, that's the basis of our behavior. But what often happens is when people start doing the search, they sort of forget about that, and in their search, they turn it into an intellectual exercise. Is particularly here in sameness, they go, oh, yes, the me, yeah, of course, it's this energy field, this whole energy field, that's me. Or, oh, no, yeah, this me is this sort of concept in my mind, you know. And so then here, then they come to the conclusion based on some intellectual idea of who they think they are, they say, that, well, that's me. But then that's not the me that we're identifying with here, you know. When we react with anger, for example, when someone criticizes us and we say, how dare you criticize me, are we identifying with some sort of aura or energy field? No. Are we identifying with some little concept in our mind? No. We have this strong sense of independent me. That's the me that we are identifying with. That's the one we need to look for here and not forget that. And when we get down here, start thinking about who we think we are based on all the things we've read and heard and our intellectual ideas, because then we've sort of lost it. So this is a very important point, that this search needs to be, we need to search for our instinctive sense of me. Otherwise, of course, here we'll come up with all very elaborate ideas about, yes, I found the me. It's this sort of like, you know, I don't know, whatever we believe in.
But essentially, it's going to shatter that concept. Well, the object is to shatter that concept.
Well, the idea is to really see whether or not this me exists. You know? And then really to see whether that me is findable here. So we have to do it in this very methodical, clear way.
Okay.
So it's not a concept.
No.
The sense of being.
No, it's not a concept.
Or a collection of thoughts.
Yeah. Of course, yeah, anyway, well, there's more to be said about that, but that's coming up next.
Am I wrong to kind of equate this in a coarser, more kind of experiential way to the whole experience of silence, which sort of cut me off from my projected me? The me that I present to the world, all of a sudden I can't do that anymore.
I was anger,
was all kinds of things. Just that, right. That you know, that, I mean, is that similar in any way?
Yeah, I mean, of course, here, if we stop identifying with this, then of course we're going to stop identifying with ourselves in as being an angry person, or this person, or that person, whatever. This is the basis of all of that projection that we give in the world. Because we have this sense of independent me, and then on top of that, then we identify that with all sorts of things, our thoughts and emotions and everything.
When I get to that point, when I'm looking for the I, and I start to not find it, I get the sense, but it seems so real. that I think that I haven't looked long enough, or that I'm, you know, like if I just keep looking, I really will find it.
Yeah, well, that's what we need to. We need to keep looking, but we need to understand that if we look thoroughly here and here, we don't need to keep looking because we've looked everywhere. Otherwise, of course, we can keep going round and round and round
right.
and round.
Well, then I think I haven't looked.
I mean, it's like, but it's the same thing. It's the same thing is the example I gave before. We have a house. We know that the house has two rooms. We know the person has two parts, a body and a mind. We see a person go into the house. We know it only has two rooms. If we look in room A and we look in room B and they're not there, do we have to keep looking for them? No. We know they're not in the house.
Mm-hmm.
Same thing. That if there is an independent me, it's got to be either within the body and the mind. If it's not in either of those two places, then it can't exist. We don't need to keep looking again and again. I mean, once we've looked in those two rooms, we don't need to go back to the first room and look again, the second room, and backwards keep going, do we?
Yeah,
no. No, we don't. Because we realize the implications of our search. If we didn't realize the implications of our search, or we thought maybe there's other rooms in the house, then we look at room A and B, and then we could go, well, maybe there's a basement or an attic or something, you know. But here we know that there is only two places to look. There's only two rooms. We know that. So why look further? We just sort of got not necessary,
yeah.
You know.
But can we know our whole mind?
Sorry? See, the thing is that whatever we believe we find as the me, if it's me, it has to have all the qualities of me. So if you believe that you find something in the mind that's me, then you can ask things like, well, I am a certain height and a certain weight. Is what I found, does that have that height and weight? Does it? Does it have... Because I have physical qualities. Does the thing I find have physical qualities? If it doesn't, it can't be me, because I have physical qualities. So if it's me, it has to have physical qualities. Otherwise, it's not me.
Okay.
So we can use this also.
Okay. That's
are these practices really separate until the very end, shamatha and this practice? I mean,
no, as we're going to see in this afternoon, on the last page, how to gain insight... is they're not separate, but
okay.
They support each other, and we have to alternate. So that whole will be answered this afternoon's session. That's this afternoon's topic. I may start touching on it this morning already. Yeah.
Suddenly, I think I'm really seeing the point of the shamatha and the stillness. If there's nothing going on, but you're still aware of it. Like, I mean, at that point, if something moves or if you went to look, like you reduce the whole field,
you can
have that house with 50,000 things going on in your head. It's just, here it all is, and it's easier. Is that, am I...
Yeah, I mean, it's the same like, again, let's say you're in a room of people. You know that you're looking for a person. You clearly know what they look like, and you're scanning the room. But while you're scanning it, you start thinking about, oh, I forgot, did I lock the house when I went home? And, you know, when you start doing that, and then you come to the end of the scan, you go, actually, I don't know. I wasn't really paying attention. I wasn't paying attention,
yeah,
so.
Yeah. So, and again, seeing,
yeah.
Never mind, I get it.
So, that's
awesome.
Okay. Right. So, then the question is, if there is no independent me, then who is the me that's doing this meditation? Who is the me that is striving for an enlightenment? So this is not saying there's no independent me. So as we saw with the chariot, the example here, we saw it says here that the self does not intrinsically exist in any of the seven ways, or effectively the two ways, the same or different than the body and the mind, yet it is still imputed in dependence upon the aggregates. So the me that exists is a me that is merely labelled on the basis of the body and the mind, or here he uses the word aggregates. So just like we said yesterday, this cup, the cup is not the collection of the parts. Because if we look at each of these parts, none of this is a cup. Yet, in dependence on this collection of parts, we label cup. So the cup is merely labeled depending on the parts. There is no cup to be found here amongst the bases. We bring it into existence by giving that label to a collection of stuff, none of which is a cup, of course. So that's the cup that exists, the cup that we can drink from and so forth. Similarly, and same with the idea of the chariot here, is the me is not the collection of the body and the mind. The me is merely labelled depending on the body and the mind. So in the basis here, there is no me to be found, but on that collection of body and mind, we label me. So that's the me that exists, the dependent me, the me that exists depending on the body and the mind. And often then we have this term that things are merely labeled. The word merely here means, of course, just only, meaning not more than that. Doesn't have a level of existence more than just being labeled or imputed or designated. So then, of course, any tradition that talks about life after life or talks about liberation has to say what goes from life to life and achieves liberation. And so here within this view, then, what is it that goes from life to life and achieves liberation and enlightenment is what's often referred to as the mere I. And mere I means merely labeled I. The I that is merely labeled on the basis of the body and the mind. Now, to explain that a little bit more, we can go back to physical reality to help us. That even in the physical world, there are no things that move through time, if we look closely. There appears to be, but in the physical world, there's just a constant flow of change happening. Within that constant flow of change, we identify certain objects, because otherwise we can't make sense of that flow. So it's not like this cup is moving through time, that this is the same cup that was here yesterday, same cup tomorrow. That's not true. We know that at the very foundation level, that simply there's a flow of physical change happening, and within that flow we are identifying objects, meaningful objects that can make sense out of this flow. So just like that, there is no me moving through time. There's no me that goes from life to life. What we can say is, of course, the me is, like the cup, is something labeled depending on the basis, on the parts, on the body and the mind. So we have a mind, and with that mind we have a physical body, and let's say that this is our life. So at the beginning of this life, then, we had the mind conjoining with the fertilized egg. And so the me that came into the life is the me that is merely labeled on the basis of this very subtle mind, the subtle mind and the beginnings of the body. And so then at any point in our life, if this is the present moment, then the me that exists in the present moment is a me that is labeled on the mind that exists now and the body that exists now. And so then this is the mere I. So we're not talking about a thing that's really moving through time. We're simply talking about the snapshot at the various points of the me. Like the snapshot that at the moment in this flow, we can see, there's a cup. Identify a cup amongst that flow, because that's useful and meaningful. Likewise here, in the present moment, the me that exists is the me that we label on the basis of the body that is present and the mind that is present now. Which means at the time of death, as we go through the death process, remember over the first four stages of the death process, our coarse body is shutting down. So at that time, the me that's undergoing the process is still a me that's labelled on the coarse body that is slowly shutting down and the coarse mind that is slowly shutting down. Then over the next three stages, the me that's undergoing the process is a me labelled on the subtle body and subtle mind that is active. So, of course, at this stage, the me is no longer human. But there's still a me. And the me is that labelled on the subtle body and subtle mind shutting down. Then in the next period, we come down to the very subtle body and very subtle mind. And so the me that's in the clear light of death is a me labelled on the basis of the very subtle mind, very subtle body. Then we go through the bardo period, where we take on a subtle body, subtle mind. So the me that's going through that is a me labelled on that subtle body, subtle mind. And then in the next life, again, let's assume it's human, the mind conjoins with a body, a fertilized egg in the womb, and then the me that starts the next life is a me labelled on that. So depending on what body and mind are present is the basis for labelling me.
Could we say that the very subtle mind energy is the me? I mean, is that present right now? Or?
It's dormant.
Dormant, not manifest.
It's not manifest. It's not manifest now. I mean, it's like, we can interpret this, we can look at this in two ways. Does your dreaming mind exist now? We can say two ways, effectively the same, but we can say it doesn't exist because it's not manifest. Or we can say it exists, but it's dormant. But either way, it's not manifest. So we only can say the dreaming me when the dream mind is manifest. We can't talk about the dreaming me now, in the present moment. There's no dreaming me. I mean, unless we're daydreaming, of course, but we can't say, you know, we're in deep sleep now, because that is not active.
In meditation, can you do some of these, like, subtle or very subtle bodies manifest? Can they?
Yeah, I mean, we can, like I said, particularly in the Tantra Vajrayana, which we haven't really looked at much, we can gain access to the very subtle mind and very subtle body. So in that state, then, the me that is active is a me based on that. But it's not that thing. It's still a me labelled depending on that. So here in this view, there's nothing we can point to and say, that's me. Can we? But that doesn't mean there's no me. The me is just merely labelled on whatever basis is present at that time.
Upon full awakening, does the very subtle mind body, does it not exist?
There are different assertions, I think, at the time of enlightenment in terms of the awareness that is present. But we can also, now we're getting into really a big area of topic, but also an enlightened being is labelled on the basis of body and mind, if we just keep it simple. I mean, their mind, of course, is completely purified.
Could you just say the explanation of merely in this context again?
So the word merely means not more than that. Now we think there's more than that. We think there's an independent me. We grasp onto independent me. So the word merely here is sort of negating that, is negating inherent existence, that things are merely labelled, that they're empty of independent or inherent existence. Just to reassert that here with the word mere. Yeah.
The mental factor that label this me or the world, it is the discrimination.
Right. So
five aggregators,
yeah.
Discrimination in the five aggregators do that, right?
Yeah. So again, yes, I mean, of course, when we perceive, I mean, we perceive colors and shapes here, and then on the basis of that collection, our mental consciousness then would interpret that, and one of the main factors involved in that is, of course, this mental factor of discrimination that would then help to be able to distinguish this as being a cup. But, of course, we can't take any mental factor in isolation. That, I mean, we have the mind and all the mental factors operating together always, yeah. Okay. Okay. Then one point here is with this topic of emptiness, as with actually a number of other topics in Buddhism, to help understand a concept, often an analogies are used to help understand the concept. And right at the beginning, of course, with the Four Noble Truths, we use the analogy of physical illness, you know, diagnosis, prognosis, cure, to understand the Four Noble Truths. Here in emptiness, there are many analogies used to try to understand what emptiness sort of means. One analogy that is used a lot, and one that I quite like a lot, and I think I've already touched it on briefly already, is the analogy of a dream. Now, if we're dreaming, then in the dream, there really appears to be an independent me and an independent objective world in the dream. And we believe that. And then in the dream, if something unpleasant appears in our dream, we often react with aversion, and or if it's an unpleasant person, maybe get angry at them or so forth. But if in the dream suddenly we realize we're dreaming without waking up, so that's what's called lucid dreaming. So if we become lucid in the dream, then there still will appear to be an independent dream me and an independent dream world. But because we're lucid now, we know that this dream world is deceiving us. We know directly that things are not as they appear. Which means that if we're lucid and we see something unpleasant in the dream, I mean, we'll realize that this dream world is really a product of our mind. And that if something unpleasant in the dream happens when we're lucid, it becomes much more difficult to have aversion or anger or hatred if it's a person. And we would enjoy the dream a hell of a lot more. This view is saying that our waking reality is like a dream, in that in our waking world, we believe there's an independent me here, independent objective world out there. That's how things appear, just as in a dream, and we believe it, because things always appear that way. And then, of course, if we come across something unpleasant in our waking world, we develop aversion. Again, if it's a person, maybe hostility, anger, and hatred. We have a lot of problems and dramas and suffering in our life because of that. But if we become lucid in our waking state, if we realize emptiness, then we will directly realize that these appearances are deceiving us. So if we realize emptiness directly, we become lucid. There still will appear to be an independent me here, an independent world there. But now, because we've realized emptiness, we will realize that these appearances are deceiving us. We will realize this world is also really a product of our mind, which means if something unpleasant appears in our waking world, it will become very difficult to develop aversion to it, or even attachment to the pleasant ones. And we would enjoy our life a lot more. So this is the analogy that's often used that can be very helpful in understanding this view of both emptiness and dependent arising.
So hearing what you just explained, then in the dream state and in the dream world, can the law of cause and effect and karma still carry through, and can we correct can we have negative and positive actions in the dream state?
Yeah. Of course... we can create karma in a dream, but it's like very, very small, very small. But what we can do is, and this is often what in Tibetan Buddhism is, that they use lucid dreaming and lucid sleep for practice. So we can use, if we become lucid in a dream, we can use that, for example, to investigate nature of reality and realize emptiness in the dream. So these sorts of practices we find in some of the very high-level tantric practices within Tibetan Buddhism. This lucid dreaming, well, it's called dream yoga, sleep yoga.
Can you do shamatha in a dream state?
Yeah, I mean, again, generally, in the dream state, I think that all of these practices, of course, is often what is missing is the clarity. But we can do all of these practices in the dream state, yes.
But, for instance, we can't accumulate the karma of killing a person by killing someone in a dream.
No, no. But, of course, if in the dream, particularly if we're lucid, we have intentionally want to hurt, then that's intention. But, of course, we're not actually killing a physical human. So, yes, it's very small. But it's still possible, but I think we need to worry more about the things we do in our waking life. In fact, when we talked about the six perfections, the perfection of each one of them has a measure of when we really perfect it. And I can't remember what some of them were, but I seem to remember that the one about ethics, the second perfection, ethics is perfected if we don't even have a non-virtuous thought in a dream. And on that point, actually, I have a story. I have a story, actually. It's about Lama Zopa, who's the head of the FPMT, which this centre's part of. And some years ago when I was studying, he was staying at our centre. And Roger, who probably some of you know, his main attendant, he wanted us to sort of better know who Lama Zopa was. So then he gathered us together one day and had a few stories about Lama Zopa Rinpoche. And one of them was that he said, you know, often Rinpoche, he does retreat, and whenever he does retreat, his personal retreat, it's complete silence, but often Roger's around supporting him and, you know, cooking for him and so forth. And then on one occasion he was in retreat, and I think it was after about a week or 10 days, suddenly Rinpoche spoke to Roger. And Roger was like taken aback because, you know, he's in the middle of retreat. And he said to Roger, he said, I have to start my retreat again. And Roger's going, why, Rinpoche? He said, I had a non-virtuous thought. So maybe it's possible.
You don't know what that was?
No. But it was after a week or 10 days.
I'm just curious about what a non-virtuous thought.
I mean, it's probably not like one of ours. Yeah.
So the person who realized direct emptiness will not accumulate new karma.
Correct. Someone who's had and this comes up in this afternoon's topic, someone who's had a direct realization of emptiness is starting to burn ignorance. And all negative actions are based on ignorance. So we start to burn all these actions. And so, therefore, it's said that certainly from the first time we realize emptiness directly, we are no longer taking rebirth through the power of these mental afflictions and karma because they're sort of burned. But we haven't yet got out of samsara. There's still more work to be done. But this is a very significant point. And I'm going to speak more about this afternoon. We're going to look at these five paths chart this afternoon.
Because they have not perfected the ethics, so technically they can still have this non-virtuous thought or intention.
Yes, but again, they can't create a negative action that would cause rebirth in samsara. Because it's not possible. Yes.
The intention is
Of course we haven't completely got rid of all mental afflictions yet.
Yeah.
But I think it says often that this is really a very significant point, and there's more to be said about that this afternoon. Well, of course, lucid dreaming, I think, actually, yeah. I mean, I think lucid dreaming can be, I mean, general lucid dreaming can be something helpful to maybe appreciate this view. And often, you know, people who get into lucid dreaming at the beginning are often sort of quite amazed at how vivid and real reality their mind can create. And so that can also be helpful in helping us to really appreciate that maybe we're sort of creating this reality. Not meaning that it's just a fabrication, of course, but meaning that there's no reality apart from our perception of it. So that can be very helpful.
So an enlightened person will, whose their experience of me is the mere I with nothing added or subtracted.
Yeah, I mean, even before that, this comes up tomorrow, I mean this afternoon rather, even before that, like before enlightenment, particularly when we've achieved nirvana, we've got rid of all ignorance and self-grasping. So even that person no longer is grasping onto the false me. And even though there appears to be an independent world, independent me to the Yahat, they know directly that everything is a dependent arising. Yeah. The difference is the appearances, but again, we're going to talk about that this afternoon. Okay. So then here in the text, we go back into the text. If we go down a little bit, sort of, there's a point D on page 42, which says how the person appears like an illusion based on that refutation. It says here, to be certain that the person is an illusory or false appearance, you need both the undeniable appearance of the person to a conventional consciousness and the ascertainment by reasoned knowledge that the person is empty of essential or intrinsic existence. If you understand this vital point, you will have solid understanding of how the force of cultivating space-like emptiness in meditative equipoise gives rise to illusion-like emptiness in the post-equipoise state. So what this is pointing to or talking about, I think I've run out of paper. Have we got any more? Too much writing. Maybe I can find a little bit of space somewhere here. I don't need much. Oh, here, this will do. We can talk about practice again in meditation and in daily life. And so we can talk about emptiness practice. Oh, here we go. Okay, this is homework. Okay. So when we talk about emptiness practice, we see the terms here, space-like emptiness. And that's referring to our meditation practice where we do the sort of meditation we described before. We sit down, we're searching for this me that really seems to be here. And if we don't find the me, that not finding, we hold that, realizing there's no independent me. And that is a very space-like experience. That emptiness is the absence of independent existence. So therefore, it's a space-like experience because it's an absence. It's a not finding. And so we are to sustain this in meditation. And then in daily life, we are to practice here what's called illusory-like emptiness. that, as the text said here, that based on our understanding and our meditative experience, then in daily life, then of course there will appear to be an independent me here and an independent world there. But based on our understanding and experience in meditation, we'll realize that these appearances are deceiving us. There is no independent me here, independent objective world there. So we therefore in daily life, we are to see things like an illusion. Because an illusion is something that does not exist as it appears. So that's what we are to do in our daily life, is to question appearances, particularly based on our understanding and experience in meditation. So if we really try in our daily life to see things like an illusion, and particularly here, what can be very helpful is in appearances that tend to be very pleasant or unpleasant, and therefore tend to be very inherently attractive or inherently unattractive, is to really see these appearances as like an illusion. That they're really, these flowers really appear to be very inherently attractive, but I know that that's not how they exist. Or very unattractive, and I know that's not how they exist. And so by doing this illusory-like practice, that will, of course, help to reduce mental afflictions. Because mental afflictions come from the opposite of that, grasping onto appearances. And also, this practice in daily life will really help feed back into our meditative practice. So if we do these two practices, then that is the best. And we can make progress, and this is what is being mentioned here in the text.
Similarly, should we try to tame the monkey during normal day? You know, not let the mind just have running thoughts?
Yeah. So, of course, with the shamatha practice, like any practice, we have two components. In daily life, we are strengthening mindfulness.
Yeah.
And, of course, remember way back at the beginning, there was that section of how, in general, to sustain meditation in daily life. So some general recommendations there was restraining the sense faculties. And within restraining the sense faculties, there are two levels. The first one, the main thing, of course, is restraining sense faculties in terms of restraining attachment and aversion. So, of course, if we have some emptiness practice, then we can do what we just mentioned. Is that when things pleasant and unpleasant come, then one way of restraining our sense faculties is through this method of appreciating that this is not inherently attractive or inherently unattractive, because I know that I've realized that. And so that's one way of restraining the sense faculties, is to restrain it in terms of not going into attachment and aversion. And at another level, of course, is then restraining sense faculties in terms of, and this can often be helpful for us as a beginner, is to not actually even come into contact with objects that overwhelm us with attachment or aversion. So there may be certain things and people in our life now where whenever we come into contact, that's it, we're out of control. Then at a beginning phase, maybe the restraining sense faculties could be not allow ourselves to go there. And then, of course, as we develop, then we can come into contact with these objects, and then restraining sense faculties is really then just the first one, of not allowing that to generate attachment and aversion. And again, one effective way is through this mechanism here. Of course, another way is understanding impermanence and many things, and also understanding that these things are not the source of happiness and suffering. I mean, we can apply many approaches.
So this idea of resting in awareness, I'm aware that what awareness feels like to me is my senses, right? I'm aware of sounds, I'm aware, and I know
that's what you're aware of.
Yeah.
Awareness is that which allows that to take place.
Yeah, how do you get there?
Again, one difficulty with this practice is people are looking for something different.
Uh-huh.
You know, where is this awareness thing?
Yeah, yeah.
But awareness is what's left over when we take everything else away. implicitly, of course, we have awareness. You know, when we're aware of the flowers, then explicitly we're aware of the flowers. Implicitly, we're aware of being aware of the flowers, aren't
we? Right.
So what we need to do is just strip away all of this, and then what's left is just awareness.
Yeah.
So it's not like we're looking for something. Where is this awareness thing? Because that's like a bit like a fish in water going, where's this water?
Uh-huh.
You know, they can't see the water because of the water.
Right.
So it's because we're still looking for some appearance. Awareness is not the appearance. We're not looking for some other deeper level of appearance.
Okay.
We're looking for what allows appearances. It's already there.
Okay.
We don't have to look for it.
Okay.
We just rest in it. We just become aware of it.
Okay.
But of course, again, you know, we have distraction, we have dullness, you know,
yeah,
which we have to work with, of course.
Okay. So you shut down all your sense faculty?
No. In this practice, if you try to block appearances, you're just going to get agitated. So in the awareness of awareness practice, we're not trying to block appearances. We're not trying to shut down the sense faculties. We're not trying to block any thoughts or emotions that are coming up. We're just simply not paying any interest in them. Of course, they'll still continue to come up. But in this practice, we're not interested in any appearances. We're interested in the awareness within which the appearances arise. So we're interested in that rather than the appearances. That's all. And of course, as with the breath practice, the more that we become absorbed in that, the less these appearances will arise anyway, over the longer term. Our mind will become more still because we're not feeding any appearances, because we're not interested in them. But if you try and block them or you follow them, of course you're feeding them. So we don't want to do that.
Would it be, again, I'm trying to just test my experience and the way you were leading us through that. I mean, is it, what I experienced was sort of a feeling of awe, you know, like that before you explain what it actually is or have the story as to, you know, just that sort of, you know, I mean, I don't know how to describe it other than that, but just sort of like a non-thinking awe state, sort of.
You're talking about emptiness or awareness practice?
Awareness.
Oh, just awareness of awareness practice?
Right.
Yeah. I mean, with this practice, and sometimes teachers say this, is that, you know, people are looking for something special, but it's completely ordinary, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
And it's the looking for specialness that blocks us from seeing it. Where's this special thing that I'm looking for? So we're still grasping. And often you hear teachers saying that this is completely ordinary. And so sometimes in these nature of the mind systems, they use, in fact, to equate with not only this awareness, but even to equate with the deeper levels of mind, they use a term called ordinary mind. But the way they use that word is not how we think. You know, for us, ordinary mind means the mind with mental afflictions and all that. But here they're talking about the underlying awareness. But sometimes they use the word ordinary mind to relate to that. Okay. Then very briefly before we break for lunch, we can go to the next section. At the bottom of page 42, which talks about how to determine there is no self in phenomena. So remember, in this system, it's very much recommended that we start our investigation into nature reality by focusing on me, the person. But then also, of course, we can turn our attention to phenomena. And here, phenomena means everything other than person. And here, there are many lines of reasoning to establish that there is no inherent existence in phenomena. The one that is mentioned here is often translated into English, the name of it, I don't know still really why it's called that, but it's called the diamond slivers meditation or reasoning. And this is the one that's used actually by Nagarjuna in his classic text, this Mula Madhyamika Karika. In fact, the very first verse of the very first chapter, the very first thing he says in the whole text, he says, no thing anywhere is ever produced from itself, from something different, from both, or without a cause. And that is the reasoning here that is mentioned, is refuting production from self, from another, from both, and causeless. And very briefly, things are not produced from themselves, because if they were, then production would be pointless because they're already existing. And if you produced itself, it would be endless. So production from self doesn't make sense. The only one that makes sense is production from other. But here, remember, we are grasping onto things existing independently. So if two things, if the cause is other, it means they're inherently other, which would imply that anything could produce anything because they're inherently different. So that's the main line of reasoning, to understand that things are not produced from other in terms of inherently other. And then, of course, production from both can be refuted because individually they've been refuted. And then also causeless production can be refuted because then, again, anything could arise from anything and anything could appear at any time. So that's one of the main reasonings that's often used to refute that thing, because if something's not inherently produced, then it doesn't inherently exist. So that's one of the approaches, reasonings that's used to help refute that things, objects, are inherently existent. But that, there's a big explanation of this in the Lam Rim, in Lama Tsongkhapa, and also in Nagarjuna's text, if you want to look at that in any more detail. And then the next section is what we're going to start, and the following section after that this afternoon, how to eliminate obscurations by becoming accustomed to those views. So we're going to look at how then we use this view of emptiness that we are establishing in meditation to overcome our obscurations. And remember, there was the afflictive obscurations, which stop us from achieving nirvana, and then those cognitive obscurations that stop us to achieve enlightenment. So we're going to look at this afternoon how we do that, and we're going to base that on this Mahayana path chart. And as part of that, the next section is how to cultivate insight. And so here we're going to look at how then we use shamatha and vipassana together to gain this insight, to gain a realization, and then how to work with that to overcome these obscurations and achieve nirvana, enlightenment. So that's the topic for this afternoon. So let's now, unless there's any last questions on what I've just mentioned. Okay, then let's do some discussion topics. The first question is, what does emptiness mean to you? What does emptiness mean to you? The second part of the first question is emptiness the same thing as things being interdependent? Is emptiness the same thing as things being interdependent? Second question, how would an experience of emptiness affect our experience of eating a delicious piece of chocolate cake? How would an experience of emptiness affect our experience of eating a delicious piece of chocolate cake?
Is that experience of emptiness while we're eating?
Yeah. So the question is, we've had some experience in meditation and that's still affecting our mind, and then after meditation we go and eat some chocolate cake, what happens?
Okay, realize
you've had some taste of emptiness in the meditation, it's still affecting your mind after the meditation, and now you're going to eat some chocolate cake, what would happen?
Okay. What did you say? Our experience of eating
a delicious piece of chocolate cake.
A delicious piece, doesn't that mean it's inherently delicious?
No. And the second part, that's for you to determine.
Right.
The second part of the second question is, how would an experience of emptiness affect our experience of meeting an irritating person at work? How would an experience of emptiness affect our experience of meeting an irritating person at work? The third question is regarding this illusory-like emptiness practice, and that is, discuss practical methods. Discuss practical methods for cultivating illusory-like emptiness in your daily life. Discuss practical methods for cultivating illusory-like emptiness in your daily life.